and this pleased him greatly. The drive to McLean had passed in silence, for much of it complete silence, because the moment Babbitt pulled out his phone to call his office and inform them he would be running late, one of the young men sitting next to him in the back of the Yukon took Babbitt's phone out of his hand and said, "Sorry, sir, operational security. No calls until we leave headquarters." The phone disappeared into the jacket of the helpful yet ominous CIA officer. At Langley, Babbitt was processed quickly and placed in an elevator that took him directly up to the top floor. As the elevator door opened, he was met by Jordan Mays, who shook Babbitt's hand as if today were just any other garden-variety day, and the impending meeting was nothing more than another discussion about contracts, fiscal year budgeting, or logistical allocations. Babbitt waited in a conference room for several minutes. He and Mays made a little small talk, but there wasn't much to it, and then Denny Carmichael entered, wrinkled and rail-thin as always. Carmichael always looked to Babbitt like a combat-hardened Abe Lincoln, as if the 16th president had spent his 20s through his 40s fighting in the Third World, as Carmichael had. Regal, yet menacing. Patriarchal, yet savage. Denny sat down at the table, folded his hands in front of him. Babbitt knew he'd get right to it, because that was Carmichael's way. The head of the clandestine service said, "Very well, Lee, you win this round." "What does that mean?"
"I don't want you talking to Congress. Our temporary discord is not as important as the long-term headache that would create."
"So?"
"So, we'll fold you back into the hunt for Cortland Gentry."
Babbitt had wanted to hear just this out of Carmichael's mouth, but when he did hear it, he instantly became suspicious.
"That quick? You went from fuck you to all's well just like that?"
Denny shook his head.
"Negative. The fuck you remains in place. Threatening to reveal intelligence pisses me off, but I'm nothing if not a pragmatist. I can't stop you with a stick, so I'll wave a carrot. See if that does the trick."
Babbitt had won, and he knew it. He fought a wide grin and a fist pump into the air by focusing immediately on the job at hand.
"Excellent. Obviously, I've been out of the loop for the last several weeks, so I'll need to get back up to speed. Does the agency have any new confirmed sightings of Court Gentry since Brussels?"
There was no hint of a pause from Carmichael.
"No, none at all. Our analysts speculate he has melted back into Central Europe."
Carmichael turned to Mays.
"How about it, Jordan? Any intel more current than that?"
Jordan Mays shook his head, an expression of gravity and disappointment.
"The trail is cold, I'm afraid. We certainly could use some help."
Babbitt appreciated the conciliation all around. He said,
"Expect that to change in short order now that Townsend Government Services is back in action."
He cleared his throat.
"While we're all here together, let's go over my terms."
Carmichael's eyes narrowed.
"Your what?"
"Terms. I want back in. Back in on everything."
"What does that mean?"
"I want the suspension of all our contracts to be rescinded, our clearance to be reinstated."
"I'm fine with that."
"And I want to see submissions from you for new contracts, new opportunities on the horizon we can bid on. This violator hunt isn't your only big operation."
Carmichael raised an eyebrow.
"It seems as if you're trying to leverage your newfound position into increased government contracts."
Babbitt smiled. He was all smiles now. He had the CIA right where he wanted them.
"Face it, Denny. I'm the only game in town."
"Of course you are."
The meeting lasted another 10 minutes. Babbitt had expected it to go even longer, but Carmichael said he had another appointment that could not wait. Carmichael and Mays watched Babbitt leave the conference room with an unmistakable saunter in his step. As soon as the door shut, Carmichael looked to Mays and sighed.
"He's got to go."
Mays just nodded, knowing exactly what his boss meant by the statement.
"I concur, and it needs to happen soon."
"How?" Mays had an answer ready.
Hightower.
Denny blew out a chestful of air while he thought.
Will he do it?
Mays said.
Back in the goon squad, Zack Hightower would do anything we told him to. He sure as hell looked gung-ho yesterday.
He did, didn't he?
Carmichael drummed his fingers on his desk.
All right, turn him loose. But no blowbacks on us.
Mays said.
Right.
He thought a moment.
Denny, we might want to look at this as something of an opportunity.
I'm way ahead of you.
I had a feeling you might be. Hightower terminates Babbitt. We float the intel in-house. It was Gentry. If nothing else, it will light a fire under Suzanne Brewer and the targeting officers. Show them just how dangerous their target is.
Denny picked up his paperwork and reached for his glasses.
Talk to Hightower.
Zack Hightower had spent the first part of the morning on the fourth floor of the old HQ building, working with Suzanne Brewer on possible staging locations Violator might use here in D.C. Former haunts in the area, suitable locations to train and store materiel. They also discussed his knowledge of current and former SAD weapon caches on the East Coast, thinking it possible Gentry would try to raid a stockpile somewhere to acquire more equipment. Zack had enjoyed this work for about half an hour, but since then, he'd been bored. This was analytical shit, not his forte. He wanted to be out in the field, in the city, manhunting. At noon, Brewer had a lunch of Chinese food brought into the Tactical Operations Center, and Zack was seated at a desk, picking through his shrimp lo mein, when Jordan Mays stepped into the room and hurried over.
I need to speak with you.
Zack put down his cardboard carton and his chopsticks, stood smartly, and stepped into the hallway. Mays looked back to Brewer as he headed out himself.
I'll have him for the rest of the day, maybe tomorrow as well.
Hightower fought a smile.
It's party time, he told himself.
The two men went upstairs to Mays's office. Once there, Mays closed the door and walked over to a small sitting area. When he and Hightower were seated close together, he leaned closer still and said,
I have a problem.
Hightower always sat ramrod straight, but he tightened his posterior chain muscles even more.
Not for long. I'll take care of it.
You know a man named Leland Babbitt?
No, sir, I do not.
He runs Townsend Government Services.
Zack nodded.
I know those assholes.
Mays sighed, adopting a worried look on his face.
Babbitt has made himself a clear and present danger to our operation at the agency. We have tried to dissuade him from this, but he persists. He has threatened to go public, detailing some classified intelligence programs that, if revealed, would be devastating for our mission here.
He shook his head, an expression of disbelief.
There is no question but that these revelations will put good men and women in the field at great personal risk. Frankly, Zack, at this point, we have exhausted all of our options.
Zack Hightower grasped instantly that he was being asked to assassinate an American citizen in the United States. He blinked hard at this realization.
But only once. I'll take care of it.
I need you to do this alone.
Of course you do. Don't worry. I'll get it done.
Denny and I are more than confident that you will. Of course, I can help you with any equipment you might need.
Zack smiled now.
Mr. Mays, this might come as a shock to you, but I've already got a couple of tools that should be suitable for the task at hand.
Mays just said,
I had a feeling you might.
Chapter 22. Raphael and his brother Raoul had no clue their customer was going to murder them, not even when two of the customer's business associates entered their garage and pulled the bay doors down, cutting off any chance for their escape. They had no real reason to be concerned. After all, the brothers had done quality work in the short time frame demanded by their customer, and he stood before them now, clearly more than pleased with the results. Merquin Alcazaz was the customer, and they had an inkling he was a dangerous man, but they couldn't have known he was a Saudi intelligence operative. Not that they would have really cared. The brothers ran a small chop shop operation just outside of Baltimore, so they dealt with all sorts of shady characters on a daily basis. They'd never done work for a foreign spy, as far as they knew, but they had no aversion to such a customer as long as he had cash. Their specialty was high-speed paint and bodywork that could make a stolen car unrecognizable, even to its owner, along with changing out VIN numbers and tags. They offered other services as well, for a premium, of course, and it was one of these special orders that would hasten them on to the end of their lives. But for the moment, they just stood there, nodded at the two men who'd entered and closed the bay doors. Before they could ask what was going on, their customer told the brothers that he and his colleagues just wanted to make sure no one on the street saw the three vehicles parked in the garage. Raphael and Raoul did not protest, chiefly because they thought they were seconds away from making a lot of money from the man who now praised them, while kneeling down next to one of the cars and running his hand back and forth over the blue decal that read, Metropolitan Police, Washington, D.C. Kaz marveled at the work done by the two Puerto Rican brothers. It wasn't just that they had turned three regular used Ford Tauruses into the spitting image of D.C. Metro police cruisers. It was that they had managed to accomplish this in only 12 hours. Kaz had come up with this plan some time ago, long before he knew the Gray Man would show up in Washington, D.C. 2 years earlier, he envisioned a number of scenarios where he would need to move men, armed men in disguise, throughout the city on either direct action or counterintelligence missions. He had his agents travel to Ohio and purchase three lightly used, late-model Ford Taurus sedans at auction, and then they brought the cars back to the D.C. area, where they stored them in a long-term garage just outside of Springfield. The Ford Taurus was the same body style as the Ford Police Interceptor sold to the Metro Police Department, so Kaz purchased the cars with the intent to turn them into mock police cruisers. After obtaining the vehicles, he searched the area via his deep back channels in the criminal underworld, looking for a person or business that had the high workmanship and low morals that he needed. He found these two brothers in Baltimore. Their chop shop had run below the radar of the local authorities, but one of the Saudis' contacts knew about them, and he passed the info on to Kaz. Alcazaz bought the lights off old junked police cars, and he had all the decals needed for each cruiser created by a company in China off of detailed images his men had made of real D.C. police vehicles. He then had the decals brought into the U.S. via the diplomatic pouch. After this, he waited. Kaz knew the minute he converted the three normal Fords into police cruisers, he would be committing a serious crime, and he did not need them for his work immediately, so he decided it would be prudent to keep everything under lock and key until he had use for the cars. He stored the decals and lights and sirens on embassy property, locked in a storage room accessible only to intelligence officers. The three Tauruses remained in the underground lot, and the phone number of Raphael and Raoul stood at the ready in his contact list, until yesterday afternoon. Now Kaz rose up from his close inspection of the last cruiser with a smile on his face.
Gentlemen, I must congratulate you again on your incredible workmanship.
Raphael did the talking, because Raoul's English wasn't good enough to understand the foreign accent of the customer.
No problem. Like I said, the paint and glaze run 1,800 total. The labor is 3 grand for each car. That's 10,800.
Kaz nodded again, and he looked at both men. They stood right next to the rear of the third white cruiser.
A fair price, I am sure, he said. Shall we all step into your office to complete the transaction?
The office was above the garage, up a small set of stairs. Raphael shook his head.
We don't leave the garage when it's open. Somebody could show up and steal something. You brought cash?
Kaz said.
Yes, of course.
He backed away from the pristine white car a few feet, hoping the two Puerto Rican brothers would follow. Instead, Raphael said,
Where are you going?
Kaz made to reach into his coat.
Just getting the money. I want to count it. Maybe the light is better here, closer to the door.
Raphael looked up at the powerful lights illuminating the four Tauruses.
The light don't get no better than it is right here. Just count out the money on the hood so we can all see it.
Kaz had been trying to get the men to step away from the car, to avoid a mess. But now he just blew out a long sigh of frustration and looked to his two associates with a shrug. Raphael said,
"The money?"
"Oh, yes, of course. I have it all right here."
His hand disappeared into his coat and then reemerged holding a suppressed Walther P-99 semi-automatic pistol. Both brothers raised their hands in surprise, but the Saudi shot them where they stood, dropping Raphael straight down to the floor with a shot to the head, and then spinning Raoul twice with two rounds to the chest. The heavyset Puerto Rican slammed into the right rear quarter panel of the closest Taurus, and he died with his body draped over the trunk of the vehicle.
"Wafakli!"
Kaz shouted. "Damn it." He jerked his head to the dead man on the car, and one of his two operatives stepped over the body, pulled it from the back of the Ford, and allowed it to slide down to the floor of the garage. A large blood smear remained on the vehicle.
"Clean it up!"
Kaz demanded. 20 minutes later, three D.C. Metro Police Department cruisers left the chop shop, hidden in a tractor trailer the Saudis had had waiting outside. The big rig drove south to Virginia, where the Saudis dropped the trailer off in a leased parking lot in Roslyn, a neighborhood of Arlington, just across the Potomac River from D.C. A two-story gated home backed up to the lot, and this was owned by a shell company for Saudi intelligence. The property had been employed as a Saudi safe house for years, and the evening before, Kaz had moved his 10 assets into the home to use it as a staging base for the duration of the Gentry operation. Back when he'd bought the Tauruses and the decals for the vehicles, Kaz had also acquired 12 police uniforms by having his agents purchase identical clothing and styles from uniform shops around the country. Shoes, utility belts, holsters, badges, buttons, and body armor were all purchased from various suppliers on the internet. The duty gun of the Metropolitan Police Force is the Glock 17, and at the same time he acquired the uniforms and accessories, Kaz also purchased a number of these handguns from a supplier in Riyadh who had acquired them directly from the manufacturer in Austria, with one major change to the actual duty gun. These Glocks were outfitted with threaded barrels, which would allow a silencer to be attached at the end. DC cops didn't use silencers. No regular police force on the planet did, but these were no regular police. They were assassins. Kaz knew this group of assets might need to keep the sound of their gunfire to a minimum, so he purchased the threaded barrels and suppressors to fit them. All these were brought in via the diplomatic pouch as well, and then locked in the care of Saudi intelligence in the embassy until this morning, when they'd been handed out to his 10 operatives. Ammunition was purchased in a gun shop in Roanoke, and even here, Kaz and his men strived for accuracy. They bought Winchester Ranger full metal jacket ammunition, similar to the duty ammo used by the MPD. While Kaz had been unable to obtain the exact Winchester rounds used by the police since it was only sold in bulk to law enforcement agencies, research into ballistics told him the civilian bullets he obtained would be virtually indistinguishable from the duty ammo when dug out of a body by a coroner or surgeon. When Kaz and his men returned with the police cars, they stepped into the safe house and saw the 7 other operatives already dressed in the full light blue on dark blue uniforms of the Metropolitan Police Department of the District of Columbia. It was an impressive sight, and Kaz knew they would look even more the part once they climbed into their cruisers. Soon, all 10 men presented themselves for inspection in DC Metro uniforms. Kaz checked them over carefully, and he was pleased with what he saw. Some of these men spoke excellent English, and others struggled, but Kaz had no plans to have them interact with the public like real police officers. No. On the gentry hunt, they would be assassins, only moved into the target area when Denny Carmichael ordered them to a location to make the kill. Chapter 23. Even though Leland Babbitt didn't make it into his office till after noon, he still worked a full 9 hours before knocking off for the day and returning to his 5-bedroom house on Cedar Parkway in Chevy Chase, Maryland. His 4-man home security detail already sat parked out front as Babbitt's Lexus rolled into his driveway. The men worked a 7-to-7 shift, giving Babbitt's property coverage through the hours of darkness. The men alerted patrols with 2 in the vehicle at all times and 2 standing on the drive, walking around to the back from time to time, and sitting on the patio furniture, periodically casting an eye out to the Chevy Chase golf course that bordered his backyard, in case any threats approached his property from the first fairway. Babbitt's wife didn't much care for the security, and she felt they were only there because Babbitt thought it made him look tough to the neighbors. But she didn't fight her husband on it anymore, especially since one of their neighbors had her Porsche SUV stolen right out of her driveway several weeks back. As he pulled into the driveway, Babbitt acknowledged the 2 patrolling security officers there with a distracted wave. He closed his garage door a moment later, then climbed out of his car and stepped into his kitchen to find his wife waiting for him there.
"It's 11, Lee. 11!
Sorry I didn't return your calls. Long day at work." He passed straight into the living room, with his wife close on his tail.
"I made dinner, you know."
"I ate at the office." He said it without looking up, because he'd pulled a bottle of 15-year-old Macallan from his bar, and was now concentrating on a 2-finger pour into a leaded crystal rocks glass. He turned towards the floor-to-ceiling windows in his living room, which gave him a terrific view of the golf course just beyond his ample backyard and a 6-foot-high iron work fence. While Babbitt faced the window, drink in hand, his wife stood behind him near the stairs. She stared him down, waiting for him to answer for himself or to notice her, neither of which he did. Babbitt's 2 kids were in college, so they had the place to themselves. But since the kids had left for school, they'd done little to take advantage of the privacy. Babbitt had been obsessed with gentry since well before Brussels, but after returning from Europe, minus a huge contingent of his men and the top-secret clearance that gave his company the access they needed to function, Babbitt had barely acknowledged the existence of his wife. His wife, who was still behind him and still hoping for some reaction from her husband, just sighed and headed for the stairs. Court Gentry moved his binoculars back and forth between Babbitt and his wife. To himself, he said, "She's pissed and he couldn't care less." Neither could Gentry, actually. He was just trying to get an accurate accounting of who was inside the property. By the time Babbitt arrived home, Gentry had already been in place for hours. He climbed over the back fence just after 8 p.m., after a 1-hour reconnaissance spent up in an oak tree on the first fairway of the golf course, and now he lay flat on his cold and muddy belly in a thick corner flower garden that was not yet in full bloom, but nevertheless provided a fair amount of cover, as long as Court remained low. He wore black Carhartt work pants, a black hoodie over a black thermal, and dark brown boots. His face was covered by his gaiter and his knit cap, and on his hands he wore black mechanics gloves. His black backpack completed the theme to his ensemble. He wasn't invisible, but he was damn close. It would take both a keen pair of eyes and a direct hit from a flashlight to notice him here. Court had spent the last 2 hours carefully thinking over his ingress to the target location. He saw several motion sensor lights closer to Babbitt's house, but he knew he could defeat them when he made his approach by simply moving slowly. All motion sensor equipment was calibrated to detect objects traveling above a certain speed, and Court had spent nearly 20 years of his life in work that, more often than one might imagine, required him to outsmart the little computer chip in a motion-detecting light. He also took care to identify the lines of sight from the different windows of the property so he could avoid advancing in view of anyone inside. It seemed to Court like Babbitt put the majority of his trust for his family's safety in the hands of his goons in the SUV out front, and the foot patrol. The Babbitts didn't have a dog. This became clear when Court scanned the perfectly green back lawn. The only disruption in the grass was on either side of a paving stone walkway that circled the house, and from the foot patrol that began once Babbitt came home, it was obvious the 2 men walking abreast were the culprits. The security officers looked competent to Gentry, but he knew they wouldn't be members of Townsend's A-team. No, these were static guards, well-trained, but not to the level of the Townsend operators he'd squared off against in Belgium. And they were well-equipped, but not as well-equipped as the men he'd fought before. That said, Court looked at their gear longingly. Each guard carried an HK MP5 9mm submachine gun hanging from a 2-point sling around his neck, and wore a black Kevlar bulletproof vest under a light chest rig that carried 3 more 30-round magazines for the subgun, as well as 2 mags for the Smith & Wesson M&P 9mm pistols that jutted out of the holsters on their utility belt. Court thought about how much he'd like to take one of these guys down, drag him back into the bushes, and liberate him of all that good gear. But that wasn't going to happen in any sort of low-profile way, so he pushed the fantasy away. Now Court observed Lee Babbitt himself standing right in front of his huge back window, exposed to the world, and he noticed the relaxed nature of the man, as well as that of his protection detail. While Gentry scanned through his binos, he thought about the lackadaisical attitude of the guard force, and he found it odd that the CIA had not told Babbitt to beef up his security profile yet. It made no sense to him whatsoever the man had not been informed that the person he'd chased all over the world was now on the loose in his own area code. Court worried this could have been some sort of trap, so he took a moment to lift his head and begin a 360-degree scan of the area. Behind him was the dark golf course. He could see it through the bars of the iron fence, and just beyond the grounds of the country club, the silhouettes of darkened office buildings rose 3 or 4 stories into the sky. To Court's left and right were other homes, and he'd neither seen nor heard humans nor dogs at either residence. And dead ahead was Lee Babbitt, his wife, and 4 armed dudes who didn't have a clue this evening was about to become the most interesting night of their careers as security guards. Now Court just needed to sit here till Babbitt and his wife went to bed. Once that happened, Court would wait for the guards to pass on their lazy patrol, then he would move to the window. He had purchased a high-end glass-cutting tool at the hardware store that could get him through the sliding doors without triggering the home alarm, although Court knew it would take at least 10 minutes to cut through both panes. He'd have to work a couple of minutes, then secrete himself from the strolling Townsend men behind some raised flower beds, before returning to work as soon as they moved around to the front. Eventually, he'd remove an 18-inch circle of the double-paned window, and he'd slip inside the home. As long as he didn't open the door or shatter any glass, the security alarm would not be triggered, and he'd be free to move around inside the home. Just then, the 2 patrolling security men made an ambling pass through the backyard. A flashlight waved in front of them but didn't reach into the corners of the property. Within a minute, they disappeared around the side of the house on their way back out front. Court looked through the back window again, and he noticed Babbitt's wife had moved to the staircase, and Babbitt himself had stepped over to his bar, facing the other direction. Court rose to his knees and began crawling through the garden, wanting to take the opportunity to cover as much ground as possible while no one was looking his way. This flowerbed continued down the side of the backyard, almost to the back patio, so Court felt confident he could come close to within steps of the back door without risking compromise.
"Here we go," he said softly, and he began his slow progression through the garden.
"When are you coming to bed?"
Babbitt's wife asked. She stood at the top of the stairs, a half-hearted attempt at a come-hither look on her face, which was hard to generate, considering the person who generated it was tired and angry, and the person it was directed to had shown not a shred of interest so far.
"Later," Babbitt replied without looking up.
"What about now?"
she asked again, hoping the cajoling would at least cause her husband to turn around.
"I'm on the scent of a new target, dear. Something big. You know it takes all my energy."
"What energy?"
She turned away. It was a rhetorical question. Before she disappeared on the landing to the second floor, she said,
"This time, do try to go after someone you can handle."
There was a mocking tone to her voice, a small riposte to her husband's rejection.
"Not like that target in Belgium, I mean. All those funeral dresses I bought to wear last month went out of fashion on the first day of spring.
Babbitt growled into his glass as he wet his lips with the Macallan.
Bitch.
He turned on the stereo, flipped to a classical station, and began pacing back and forth across the living room, backed by Shostakovich's Eighth Symphony in C minor. His mind tuned out his wife's barbs, and it went back to spinning with ideas and planning, logistics and tactics.
"Where the hell are you, gentry?"
he said softly, standing at the floor-to-ceiling window now, looking out over his back lawn and garden, and the dark golf course beyond it. Babbitt paced, struggled with the mindset of an assassin. Gentry would have fled Belgium for certain. The CIA thought he was in Central Europe, but Babbitt disagreed. Fleeing the continent was Gentry's usual M.O. after a big operation. But where would he go? Latin America? No, that had been his last distant refuge. He wouldn't go back, not yet. Africa was out. He'd gotten himself into quite a bit of trouble there a couple of years ago. Of course, it was a big continent, but Babbitt just didn't see Gentry returning to Africa now.
Asia?
Yeah, maybe. Babbitt finished the last swig of his scotch, stepped back to his little bar, and made himself a third drink. Returning to the window, he thought about Asia again.
Asia, yes, Babbitt said.
He felt confident he was in Gentry's brain now. He knew where he'd go. Immediately, Babbitt pulled out his phone and began thumbing through contacts, looking for the number of his Hong Kong-based agent. It would be mid-morning there. He could reach his man and get him started on building an infrastructure for the hunt to come. Absently, while he scrolled through his phone, he lifted his rocks glass to down a swig of Macallan. Just as he brought it up to chest height, the glass cracked, broke apart, and fell from his hand, dousing his shirt and trousers with the tepid scotch. Babbitt looked down at the mess, an expression of mild surprise on his face. He took a half step back, concerned he'd cut his hand on the lead crystal. Then he saw the blood, and it wasn't on his hand. A hole in the middle of his white shirt, just to the left of center, from which redness grew, expanding. Leland Babbitt dropped his phone on the floor, brought both hands to his wound, realizing only now that he'd been shot. He was in the industry, so he recognized within another second that the shooter must have employed a suppressed weapon. He looked up to his sliding glass door, just 5 feet in front of him, and he saw the hole in the glass at chest height, and he looked beyond the glass and saw movement in his garden on the far edge of the patio. A dark silhouette appeared from his rose bushes, turned, and began running towards his back fence.
"Gentry!"
It came out in a hoarse whisper, and then Leland Babbitt dropped dead in a heap on the floor. Leland Babbitt was the first person, but certainly not the last person, to believe with absolute conviction that he had been assassinated by the Gray Man. Court was on the move before Babbitt's face slammed down on the living room tile. He'd heard no gunshot, but the screaming bullet had zinged through the night air from behind him on his right, crackling by at high speed 30 or 40 feet off his right shoulder, and then snapping through the window glass. Gentry gave up stealth for speed in his race to leave the scene, because he needed to get the hell out of here as fast as possible. He had a litany of immediate concerns, and none of them would go away as long as he remained hiding in the garden bed. He was worried about the sniper, of course. There was a guy out here with a gun and eyes on the back of the property, but he was several orders of magnitude more concerned about the armed assholes on the property. Court had closed to within 20 feet of the back door, and as soon as Babbitt's body was discovered, the estate would be locked down tight, lights would turn on, and Gentry would be way too close to avoid detection. Two members of Babbitt's security detail were somewhere walking the grounds. They carried HK submachine guns, and Court only had a tiny 380 to fight them off. Court knew if they saw him, it was going to be a fucking mess. He ran to the iron fence, but he hesitated climbing over it, because he had no idea if the sniper was still watching. It occurred to him that since Babbitt's body had not yet been discovered, it might be better if he stayed here, at least for a minute or two, to give the shooter time to break down his position and leave his sniper's hide, thus giving Court a better opportunity to... Babbitt's wife screamed in the house, her cry loud enough to be heard easily here 40 yards away, and certainly loud enough to alert the security officers.
Fuck,
Gentry thought, and then he climbed the fence, careful to avoid using his injured right arm for weight-bearing duty. Chapter 24. Zack Hightower took his eye out of the scope the instant he saw his target drop. He knew Babbitt wouldn't be getting back up after taking a 168-grain, 308 caliber high-performance boat tail round to his center mass. So, Zack began his exfiltration process immediately after confirmation of his kill. He had no need to scan around the property or to look for more targets. This wasn't combat. This was a sanctioned termination. His target was down, and it was time to go. He unscrewed the silencer from the barrel of his Remington Defense CSR concealable sniper rifle. Then he unscrewed the carbon fiber-wrapped barrel from the receiver and slipped it into the oversized gym bag next to him. He collapsed the stock against the receiver, placed the gun and the silencer in the bag, and zipped it up, and then moved in a low run back to the staircase. 30 seconds later, he exited the fire escape door of the 3-story office building, and he stepped out onto a dark street in an industrial park that had long since emptied out for the night. Zack was proud of his shot, though he acknowledged to himself 435 yards into a man-sized target was nothing for a man of his skill set to write home about, really. Still, he'd removed a bad actor off the stage, an enemy of U.S. intelligence and a threat to his brothers and sisters in the agency. He knew this to be true because his leaders told him it was true. He did not question. He did not second guess. He did not hesitate. That was not Zack Hightower's way. As he began walking to the north, he was surprised to hear gunfire behind him, but not surprised enough to go back and take a look. He assumed Babbitt's men had discovered the body, they'd freaked out, and then they'd found something or someone in the neighborhood to shoot at. Good, thought Zack. Nothing like a little fog of war back at the scene to help him get clear of the area. Court knew he'd been spotted running across the first fairway of the golf course because he'd been shot at already. A short burst from an MP5 had blown lily pads out of a water hazard to his left, and a longer burst kicked up fescue that ran alongside a bunker on his right. He continued running off the turf and up into the natural area that divided the first green from the 18th green. His short-term goal was putting distance between himself and the shooters, because he knew the shortcomings of their weapons. The MP5 was an excellent submachine gun at submachine gun range. Certainly, at targets under 50 yards, it was first rate, and with careful, judicious marksmanship, it was accurate enough at a distance more than 4 times that. But the Townsend men's weapons had no advanced sights, and they were firing the HKs in automatic bursts while pursuing their target, and this reduced their accuracy and enhanced Court's chances for survival, as long as he could keep those chattering guns far back behind him. He caught a brief respite from the incoming fire when he entered the trees and the darkness there, but he didn't slow, because he looked back over his shoulder and saw the headlights of the Lincoln Navigator bouncing onto the golf course just to the north of Babbitt's home. The SUV charged onto the first fairway at high speed, just 100 yards from Court's position. Court's old Ford Escort was parked in a lot 2 miles to the north, but he turned to the south because he knew there was no way he'd make it to safety before the SUV caught up with him. No, his only hope now was to run, to evade the Navigator by moving into and out of the natural obstacles here in the dark golf course, and to find his way back to his car at some point much later in the evening. Court decided he'd do his best to stay in the dark and get out of the golf course onto one of the main streets, to try and steal a car or find some sort of in extremis hide site. He rounded a large pond, his tactical brain still acutely aware of the location of the black Lincoln Navigator, which now barreled through the tree line and spun onto the 18th fairway, behind him on his right. Court dropped to his knees below the lip of a rise, hoping the vehicle would pass him by and continue to the south. But just as he lay on his stomach, a burst of fire came from the center of the first fairway on his left, and it sent supersonic rounds zinging over his head. The navigator must have dropped off at least one man there before racing ahead. Court had Babbitt Street and at least one shooter to his left, a vehicle with an unknown number of shooters 25 yards to his right and passing to the south, and the one place Court could not go was back to the north, because his car was parked there and he could not lead his opposition in that direction. Court drew his pistol, leapt to his feet, and ran to his right. The navigator passed him on the fairway. Court charged behind it as it roared by, hoping like hell they didn't see him running out of the rough in his dark clothing. He sprinted deeper into the golf course, racing for the tree line that separated the next fairway from this one, but he heard the SUV on his left slam on its brakes, tearing up the pristine wet turf as it slid to a stop. He'd been spotted. Court ran on, across a wide green, towards a thicker grove of pines, and just when he thought he'd make it to the trees without being shot at, the barking fire of two MP5s behind him told him men had dismounted from the Lincoln and were well aware of his location. As he entered the trees, thousands of needles exploded off branches. Bullets ripped through the thick grove, the pounding sound of metal striking wood, and the smell of fresh pine prevalent in the cool night air. A round whined by within a foot of Court's right ear, and he dove forward and rolled at speed down a hill out of the copse of pines, end over end, tumbling down until he landed flat on his face in a sand trap, moist and sticky with nighttime dew. Chapter 25. Zach Hightower could no longer hear the gunfire. He sat behind the wheel of his F-150 pickup, heading north through Bethesda, listening to an overnight AM talk radio station. A man had called in to tell the host about his recent alien abduction, and Zach was already absorbed in the story. His cell phone rang, and he snatched it out of the center console and held it to his ear while he drove.
"Yeah?"
Mays said.
"You need to get out of there!"
Hightower made a face at the phone.
"What are you talking about? I'm clear." "Traffic on the Townsend Interteam radios claims they are converging on a fleeing subject through the golf course." "It's not me, boss. I'm Golden."
Mays was confused.
"I'll call you back."
"Roger that,"
Zach said, and he hung up the phone and turned up the radio. Denny Carmichael had decided to spend another night in his office. He'd already changed into his nightclothes, but he'd remained at his desk, waiting to hear confirmation of Babbitt's death. He had Mays listening in on the Townsend frequency in his office, and he had confirmed the kill just 2 minutes earlier. Carmichael turned off his computer and stood up from his desk now, getting ready to lie down on the couch and turn off the lights. But his phone rang again, surprising him. He snatched it with irritation.
"What is it?"
Mays spoke in his clipped tone.
"Townsend is chasing a man who was on the property at the time of Babbitt's shooting."
He paused an instant.
"I spoke with Hightower. He's clear."
Carmichael understood almost instantly.
"Gentry. Who else could it be? I'll deploy JSOC." "Do it. The local police will get there first, but if Gentry squirts out of the police cordon, maybe they can get a shot at him."
Carmichael hung up and immediately picked his secure mobile off his desk. He sent a brief text to Kaz. "Violator spotted in Chevy Chase, under pursuit by private security. Vector to police traffic in area." It took less than a minute for the text reply. "Understood." In Arlington, Virginia, three Washington, D.C. police interceptors raced out of a parking lot and headed north, taking similar but separate routes. At this time of the evening, it would take them less than 20 minutes to arrive at the destination, not that they knew exactly where they were going at this point. They would listen to police bands during the ride up, however, so they hoped to have a good idea of the location of their quarry by the time they got close. Court Gentry crawled back up to his feet in the bunker alongside the 12th green, spit out a mouthful of sand, and looked around. He saw the far edge of the golf course and a low wall there, and beyond that, the streetlights of a busy intersection. There were several closed businesses up and down the street, but on the corner he saw the bright lights of two that appeared to be open. He told himself he had to make it to the street to have any chance of getting away from his pursuers. He raised his little pistol and fired 2 rounds into the air as he ran for the wall and the street, hoping any dismounts behind him and in close pursuit would hear the gunfire and worry they were being targeted. It was a weak move, a Hail Mary that, at best, could buy him 5 seconds as the attackers dropped to the ground or ducked behind a tree. But until he got to the cover of the buildings on the other side of the street ahead, he saw no other option. He made it across the last fairway without getting shot at again, though he heard shouts far behind him. He ran onto the 9th green, close to the clubhouse, and sprinted down a gentle hill towards the intersection. Another cycle of automatic fire erupted from back at the pine trees. Bullets impacted the tall windows of the clubhouse restaurant, 12 yards from court, and the glass of the massive wall of windows cracked and shattered. He thought about seeking cover inside the dark building, but he knew the men behind would see him enter, and although he could probably hold them back a minute or two with his pistol, he certainly couldn't wait them out, because the police would just surround the building and fill it with tear gas and tactical officers. Court ran on for the wall at the edge of the country club. When he arrived at the wall, he climbed over and dropped down on the other side. He still wore his gaiter high on his face and his cap low, so he imagined he must have been an intimidating sight for the cars passing him on Wisconsin Avenue, even though he'd stowed his handgun before vaulting the wall. Looking to the left, he thought he might be able to find a vehicle moving slow enough towards the intersection on his right so he could stop them at gunpoint, but all the traffic he saw moving through the intersection was heading east to west at speed, and he was in the northbound lane. Shouts behind him at the wall of the golf course told him the dismounted Townsend men were close, but he'd lost the navigator somewhere back on the other side of the copse of pines. He raced across Wisconsin Avenue towards the lights of the open businesses, a McDonald's and a 24-hour pharmacy. Bursting armed into an occupied commercial space was not his first choice, but to break into a closed building involved slowing to pick a lock or stopping to find something to smash a window with. And considering the armed security men so close on his heels, he knew he didn't have the time he needed for either. As he entered the parking lot of the McDonald's, he noticed a dark alley behind the restaurant, and beyond the alley was an 8-foot-high chain-link fence with a thick hedge on the other side. Court's spirits rose quickly when he saw this. He felt sure he could enter the restaurant to misdirect the men chasing him, and then immediately exit at the rear of the restaurant. Once he did this, he could climb the fence, push through the foliage, and find himself in a new neighborhood, where he had a chance to get away. For the first time, he heard the sound of approaching sirens. They weren't right on him, but they were close enough to where he knew this entire section of the city would be locked down tight within minutes. Just before he put his hand on the door of the McDonald's, he looked back into the intersection behind him. The black navigator was there, approaching in his direction and slowing next to 2 armed Townsend men in the middle of the street, who kept running towards him as they pointed his way.
"So much for ordering a chocolate shake and waiting this out,"
Court thought to himself. He heaved the door open and ran inside. Chapter 26 Court drew the Ruger from his front pocket as he entered the restaurant. There were only a 6 or so tables occupied, and everyone looked up as the man clad head to toe in black raised a small pistol over his head. He shouted in his most commanding voice,
"Everybody out!"
And for additional emphasis, he fired 1 round into the ceiling. Screams and squeals erupted from both the dining room and the 3 employees behind the counter. The customers all jumped up from their tables and raced to the back door of the dining room, pushing one another to get out of the door. Some ran straight to their cars, others to the safety of the all-night pharmacy next door. Court rushed to the counter now, yelling at the employees, ordering them to leave. A panicked young man in a mustard-colored uniform held 1 hand up in surrender and, with the other, pushed a button on his register, opening the till, just as Court stepped behind the counter. Gentry slammed the drawer closed and grabbed the young man.
"I said go, kid!"
He shoved him towards the exit. The teen followed his co-workers to the front door. Court raced into the kitchen now, just as he saw the last cook run through the back door of the building and out onto the raised concrete loading dock in the back alley. Court charged to the back door himself, ready to make for the back fence. He managed two steps out the rear door before the navigator screeched into the alley on his left. Its headlights illuminated everything, and there was no way in hell Court would make it over the fence and into the cover of the neighborhood on the other side without being seen and engaged. The Cooks ran around the corner in the direction of the front parking lot, but the driver of the navigator obviously saw Court because he slammed on his brakes in the center of the alley. Court stopped, turned around, and retreated back into the McDonald's, but as he passed through the door, he fired a round into the exterior light over the door, blowing it out with a shower of sparks. A man in the front passenger seat of the SUV reached out with a handgun and raised it at Gentry, only 25 feet away. Court dove for the hard floor of the kitchen as the pistol cracked loud in the alleyway behind him. The round hit the door 3 feet above his back. He kicked the door shut, then looked around the kitchen, weighing his options. He knew going back out front wouldn't work. There would be at least two men there armed with submachine guns, possibly already inside the restaurant. Court thought it possible the Townsend men would just cordon him off here and wait for the cops to arrive. But he also knew they would all be ex-military and sure of their martial skills. They would take it personally that, in their understanding of events anyway, the man in the McDonald's kitchen just murdered their employer on their watch, and that would piss them off to no end. Court darted back through the kitchen, in the direction of the front counter, and as he did so, he noticed a metal ladder fixed to the wall on his right, just next to a walk-in freezer. Looking up, he saw the ladder led to a roof access hatch. Court liked having the option of escape from the kitchen, even if he wasn't quite sure what good this ladder would do him. If he made it onto the roof, he'd be even more stuck than he was here, since at least here, at ground level, he had access to multiple exits. Court stopped in the middle of the kitchen, trying to decide his next move. He had exactly 5 rounds of .380 ammo in his mouse gun. Whether it was the cops or the Townsend boys who eventually kicked in the doors of this Mickey D's, Court knew he was in serious trouble. He looked back at the door again, just as it began to open. Court ran around a stainless steel prep table in the middle of the room and slid on his butt along the greasy tile floor, next to a row of griddles and 3 large fry vats. Then he crawled forward, out of the line of sight of anyone at the open back door, which was only 10 feet from where he knelt. He looked between a low open shelf of metal pots and pans below the prep table, and he saw one of the Townsend men enter, his submachine gun up at his shoulder, scanning for threats. Court fired twice between the pots and pans, hitting the operator at the door once in each calf. The man dropped flat on his back, inside the door, screaming in agony. Court fired 3 more times toward the dark opening of the back door, sure another man would be entering just behind his mate, because he couldn't imagine any scenario that had one guy hitting the building on his own. He heard his second shot clang off of metal, and he thought he might have hit the MP5 in the operator's hand. He knew this would slow the man but not stop him, because the man would simply transition to his pistol and come through the door to the aid of his partner. Court's handgun was empty now. Quickly he rolled up to his knees, reached over to the stainless steel counter next to him, grabbed a fist-sized aluminum can, and threw it out onto the darkened loading dock. As he did so, he shouted, "Frag out!" The can banged against the door jamb, then bounced onto the concrete dock and clanged against a metal garbage can there. If the Townsend operator had military experience, which Court suspected he did, then he would naturally think someone had just tossed a fragmentation grenade just feet away from where he stood. Court heard the sound of a man covered in metal and other gear clambering over an iron railing, and then dropping onto the asphalt of the alleyway 4 feet below with a loud crash. On his hands and knees, Court crawled to the back door and kicked it shut again. Then he crawled over to the injured operator on the floor. The man had rolled up onto his knees, and he reached out for his weapon on the tile, but he sensed movement, and he turned, looked up, and saw a man in black flying through the air at him. Court tackled the wounded man back to the ground. Straddling the security officer now, Court held his empty little pistol against the man's sweat-covered forehead, and the wounded man went still, his eyes crossed looking at the gun. Court didn't say a word. Instead, he just pulled the Smith & Wesson pistol out of the man's drop-leg holster, flicked off the safety, and fired 4 rounds into the front wall of the kitchen, hoping to discourage anyone with ideas about rushing into the kitchen. Now Court tossed his empty Ruger to the side and shoved the hot Smith into his waistband, along with another handgun magazine pulled from the Townsend man's load-bearing vest. He also removed the 3 long HK submachine gun magazines from the vest. He waved the 3 mags back and forth over the face of the man lying on his back and bleeding from the calves. Court said,
"Listen up. I know you're hurting, but if I were you, I'd figure out a way to move."
Court stood, turned to his right, and tossed all 3 magazines, each loaded with 30 rounds of 9mm ammunition, across the room. All 3 plopped into one of the big vats of molten hot fry grease positioned against the wall.
"No!"
the injured man shouted, his eyes wide with disbelief, and then he rolled over on his stomach and began crawling, using only his arms to drag himself across the floor towards the back door. Court scrambled across the room to the walk-in freezer, entered, and yanked the door shut behind him. It was silent in the kitchen, save for the grunting and groaning of the man on the floor, struggling to pull himself as fast as he could. He had just reached the back door, pulled it open with his arm, and rolled out onto the concrete loading dock, when 2 Townsend operators, moving in a small tactical train, spun into the kitchen from the front counter area. Both men covered a different section of the kitchen with their submachine guns. The man on the left traced the front sight of his weapon over the walk-in freezer, the cooler, and the dry storage pantry. The man on the right saw in his sector his wounded comrade rolling out the back door, the wash area for the mops by the door, and the main kitchen prep area with the stainless steel table, the grills, the ovens, and the 3 big fry vats. Left called,
"Clear!"
Wright hesitated, then he shouted,
"Get down!"
Chapter 27. The operator on the right had seen the bubbling vat of grease spewing, and he had sensed trouble, but not in time to avoid it. Just as both men looked to the right, the center vat popped once, spraying red-hot grease into the air. Neither man was hit by either a round or the burning liquid, but a second after this, just as both men turned away to run for cover, the remaining 89 rounds of 9mm ammunition cooked off nearly simultaneously. The cacophonous explosion blew fire, bits of metal, and hot cooking oil in all directions. The bullets were not traveling through rifled barrels, so they were nowhere near as deadly as actual gunfire, but they were still capable of causing serious wounds. The brass-jacketed projectiles, along with scalding oil, cartridges, and bits of metal fry vat itself, slammed into both men as they tried to run, knocking them back through the passageway into the counter area of the restaurant. As soon as the boom of the explosion diminished, Court exited the door of the walk-in refrigerator, grabbed the metal ladder on the wall next to him, and climbed up. It was hot with fry grease and slippery as hell, but he held on, fighting his way to the ceiling access hatch. He opened the door, rolled out onto the flat roof, and rose to his feet. Court ran straight to the front edge of the building, hoping to somehow shimmy down to the parking lot, but when he got there, he saw a half dozen police cars rolling into the lot from the intersection, their lights flashing. Shit! He turned and raced along the roof in the opposite direction. He stopped at the south side of the building now, hoping no one would see him here. He looked over the side, a dozen feet straight down onto asphalt. He couldn't make that drop quickly without running a high risk of hurting a knee or an ankle, which would make his escape nearly impossible. Court turned and rushed to the rear of the restaurant now, thinking the loading dock might be high enough for him to drop down onto. But quickly he saw that was no good either. There were 2 Townsend men here, and although one man was wounded, both were armed, and the back door to the restaurant was open, allowing anyone inside a view of the loading dock. Court ran to the north side, desperate for any option now, and an option presented itself immediately. As he ran, he saw a Montgomery County Police Department SUV, its lights and sirens blaring, racing through the parking lot. Court knew where the officer was heading. He would be part of the cordon of the scene, moving to the alleyway to cut off any escape through the back door. Court knew that this moving vehicle was his one ticket off the roof of this McDonald's. He turned and chased after the SUV, running for the back corner of the roof as fast as he could, knowing the vehicle would have to come close to the building here to pull into the alley to seal up the